This time in the Magic Kitchen, we're joined by author Ben Stimson to discuss ancestral veneration.
I'm Leandra Witchwood.
And I'm Elise Wells.
And welcome to the Magic Kitchen podcast, where we talk about magic, kitchen witchcraft, herbs,
and everything in between.
The Magic Kitchen podcast is fully and independently funded by the Witchwood Tea House. So show us some support and head over to thewitchwoodteahouse.com to purchase some deliciously hand-blended loose leaf teas or one of my other botanical products. As a special thank you for your support, please use POD15 at checkout to take 15% off of your next order. So without any further ado, let's get to the episode. Blessed be. Okay. So what are you up to? What are we up to? There's so much going on. I feel like April is such a busy, busy month. I have the workshop coming up at the end of this month, the free workshop. So if you haven't signed up for it already, get in on that. I'm ending the day with a ritual. Today, as we're recording this, I am getting ready for the Heng Lung concert in DC.
Woo! I'm so excited.
I'm so pumped for y'all. I wish I could go. Like, if I was in the States, you know, I'd be with you.
I wish you were here. Like, it's going to be epic. From what I understand, like, everybody who's ever gone to one of their concerts is like, oh my God, it's an experience. It's not just a concert. It's an experience.
Oh, that's so awesome.
And we missed them last time they were here. So we're super pumped and excited.
Yeah.
And, oh gosh, what else? There's so many things going on. Like, the end of this month, so the May Day Fairy Festival, the Spoutwood Farm Fairy Festival, I'll be there. So if you're going to be at that festival, like, find me.
If you are in a 3-hour or so radius of that festival, It is at Marshy Creek, Maryland. It is so worth going. Is it at Marshy Creek?
It's at Rocky Point.
Rocky Point?
Yeah. Yeah, is they moved it from the Marshy. Yeah.
Interesting. It is literally, like, my favorite festival I've ever been to. Like, I was so bad I could figure out a way to go every year. Like, I'm literally
need to come out here. Yeah, just come out here. Right now.
Yeah. Just spend $1,500 on a flight.
Just come on.
Yeah. No, like, it, I do love it so much though. Like, I wish.
Yeah, it is so much fun.
Arrange. Maybe next year. Maybe I can.
Yeah, next year.
Arrange next a book year, tour but, around that.
And such a I think I can officially announce this now. I will be at Templefest this year. Woo! I have been accepted as a presenter, so I will be doing a workshop, an interactive workshop there. So, yeah, if you want a really cool weekend with Christopher Pensack and his group.
It's in August,
and a bunch
right?
of other people. Yeah, it's in August. August 30th through September 2nd.
Nice. So,
yeah, we're going to be in the woods having fun. Doing witchy shit.
I love it. Oh, that's so cool.
I know I'm forgetting things. There's so many other things going on. But yeah. Whew. This has been, like, the past few weeks have been incredible. Just a whirlwind of stuff. So
that's awesome. Yeah. What do you got going on? I love the way spring sort of pulls us out of the cocoon of winter.
It really does.
Like, it's a bit of a whirlwind, like you said. Like, I find that I, like, coyly sort of approach spring, and then once I take her hand, she grabs me and takes me on an adventure. Yeah, like, but I'm here for it. Like, I've been going to a lot of ritual. There is a group I've been practicing with called Labris, which is the double-headed axe from Minoan mythology, you know, Kriti and Knossos and all those beautiful imageries. And they do rituals for the Athenian calendar. So, you know, it's not specific to any God or anything like that. It's not quite reconstructionist, just because we can't actually, we've talked about this a lot on the podcast, like, you can't really reconstruct exactly what the ancients did, but it's heavily inspired. You know, it's well done. They use the Orphic hymns and Homeric hymns in ritual, and we do it at the ancient temples, and it's been so fulfilling and so rewarding. I actually recently redid my altar and finally graduated from, like, you know, the side table sized altar to a full vanity. It is like literally twice the size now. And it feels so good. Like I have more room for offerings, which is my biggest endorsement for bigger altars. And yeah, it's just, it's been a good journey. And it's also my birthday. If you're listening to this, my birthday just passed. So I just feel really good in Taurus season. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. I'm in Malta as you're listening to this, if you're listening live, actually. It's really fortunate, but also a bit unfortunate because my husband doesn't love to go to these things. But every year in Malta, they host a Regency weekend. So if you follow me on Instagram, you know that one of my guilty pleasures is historical dress, and specifically the Regency period, because it's the most comfortable clothing ever, at least for women. The men's clothing looks very tight and uncomfortable, but the women's is great. I wish I could wear it everywhere all the time. And so, yeah, it's like the best birthday present to myself that I get to go to this. So, yeah. And then in May, I have crazy stuff going on, but I will save it for May because it's fun. But don't miss it. I am teaching an online workshop May 11th on green magic. I'm calling it Of Leaf and Stone. And we're going to talk not only about folk practices you can use as a green witch and how green witchery, natural magic, it can be embedded in any spiritual practice. You don't have to exclusively work with plants or something like that. And we also were going to talk about land spirits, of course, because I can't not. And how to engage with plant allies and how to meet the land and bring it into your practice in your home, in your kitchen, and at your altar. So yeah, get your tickets. There's early bird tickets for sale. Nice. It's for two more days if you're listening to this live.
Oh, wow. Like time is flying. I can't believe that we're at the end of April already. We're mid-April.
It's crazy. It's wild. But we're along for the ride.
I know, right? like I said, the slingshot. Like we're just being shot out into everything. It's so crazy. But
thanks for being on this wild ride with us, everybody.
I know, right? Yes. We love it.
Ben Stimson is a therapist, lecturer, student, and spiritual director. Ben has developed courses on a variety of topics, including ancestor veneration, the power of story, and folklore. When not working with clients or writing, Ben is engaged with his areas of study: religious studies, medieval and classical studies, folklore, and spirituality. Learn more at benstimson.com.
Welcome to the podcast. Ben. Yeah.
Hello. Thank you. That sounds very impressive, doesn't it? Half the time, I don't even realize what I'm on my plate half the time.
I feel that. Yep. Yeah. People tell me, like, why didn't you tell me you do that? I'm like, because I forgot.
I completely forgot. Well, it's like Morgan Daimler said, my friend Morgan said, she said, or they said, you know, record everything, like write everything down, because, you know, when you get into this like line of work, you know, you're constantly doing things all the time just to get more attention.
Yeah. Yeah. And the more you do, the more you forget that you did.
This is true. Yeah. Until you write one of those bios and you're like, yeah. Oh, man.
I'm just glad that I'm not the only one that forgets like all of my credentials and all of the history that I've done. You know, well, if you've been practicing for a hot minute, like 20 years or so, like that's a lot of stuff to cram into a couple of decades. So yeah, you forget.
And it's funny how fast bios go out of work, right?
Yes, they do. Yeah, you have to update them constantly. But I'm fascinated. I'm fascinated by this book and I'm fascinated by your bio. So I'm excited for this one.
I wrote it myself.
Oh, good. Hey.
And it has pockets.
I love it. That was awesome.
Okay. Yeah, it's still surreal to me that I even have a book. We were talking before we started recording, and it's so weird. Like I log on to Facebook just before we started recording, and the Frankfurt Book Fair is on, and they have pictures on the Llewellyn website and of all the props and all that. And I'm like looking all the, and I see my book just underneath Christopher Hughes's book, and I'm like, oh, I have a book.
There it is. It's wonderful.
Bizarro. It's so weird. Yeah. It's so weird.
Well, and actually I liked reading in your book that this began as a course. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's a good way to describe the book as well. Like I said from like chapter one, I was like, this is the book I wish I had when I first began Ancestor Practice. Like over a decade ago, if I had found your book, I think my practice would have been more solid faster. So that's the best recommendation I have for this book. And I agreed with Ronald Hutton, hard not to agree with him, but that it's erudite, you know, like you have a lot of sources, a lot of traditions represented in very sensitive ways. And anybody from any background interested in ancestor work will find something to dive off into.
Very much so. And that was very intentional. The only criticism I've had about the book is that it doesn't give you anything to do. It doesn't give you tradition. It doesn't give you rituals to do. But the person was very fair, and they said even within the review, but I can understand why they wrote it this way. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those, when I looked at what was available for ancestor work, really this goes back to me and my experience in Lukumi. So when I was starting to put the course together, I was doing psychotherapy training, and also I was involved in Lukumi Ile. And for those of you who don't know that word, it's Santeria. So it's Cuban Orisha tradition. And ancestor work is really strong in those traditions, really the foundation of everything that is built off of those. So when I looked at bringing in my own background and really reconnecting with my blood ancestors anyways, I saw on the market were, you know, books on, well, there was one book on karmic ancestors, which isn't really my thing. Let's just say that right off the bat. But also a lot of tradition-bound ancestor works. So there were books on, you know, ancient Greek tradition. There was books on Celtic ancestor work. There was books on, you know, very specific African traditions, all of these things. So for me, I was like, well, what do you do if you're caught in between traditions like I am? And I feel like a lot of people, especially now, are practicing multiple traditions. They're not sure how to blend them, syncretize them, navigate between them all. Many people have many mixed heritages, at least blood relatives. And so how do you blend multiple cultural traditions in this melting pot that is, you know, settler communities, right? So it became very important for me to work with my clients around this, because a lot of the stories that show up in the psychotherapy chair come from family stuff, right? I don't think that is, you know, too much of a generalization that therapists are often writing mother and mother and mother when somebody's in the therapy chair, you know?
Yeah. Well, and it's funny because that was one of the things I did want to talk about is like you said, for the most part, folks have diverse backgrounds. Right. And you add to that we almost rarely these days live where we grew up. Like for the most part, people travel at least a good, you know, 20 miles to the nearest city. Or like for myself, I've lived on three continents and I have three continents worth of ancestry, four really. So how do you reckon with that? And I think your book is comforting for folks like me, because there's, you know, like if you read the older books, you know, like we're talking 70s, 80s, there's a lot of like blanket warnings against mixing pantheons, mixing traditions. This is under lock and key. This is initiatory only. And it's like, well, what's left? How do I sift through and discard and then find what's allowable in quotation marks? Mm-hmm. So it's very nice to find a book that just, you know, I would say too, you're never didactic in here. Mm-hmm. You're letting the reader say, this is nice. Oh, I like that. Let me write that down. Let me highlight that. It's not like, and this is that, and this is how this should be, and this is what you should do next, which is so important. It's really a great tone shift from a lot of ancestor books I've read.
Well, and I feel like there's a lot of finger wagging with ancestral books, because the people who are writing them often are the same people who are reading them, right? So they're in the same kind of mindset of, oh, I need to be careful, or I'm just going to appropriate this left, right, and center, or you can do all of this stuff. But where's the relationship, right? For me, really, and again, this comes from that therapy perspective. For me, it spiritual practice and religion and anything I do, magic, has to emerge from worldview. We all come into the world with a worldview. We all come into the world in a certain context, and that is going to affect us. And I feel like with modern paganism, at least, the struggle is, how do I connect with these ancestors who are all Christian going back 1500 years, or in some countries, 2000 years? What do I do with them? What all of the traditions connected with them are part of these traditions I don't want to be part of. How do I reconcile my paganism with these Christian ancestors? So what do people do? Well, they talk about their strong pagan ancestors. And that's ludicrous. And I'm sorry, like, I hope that this doesn't change the tone of the book, but it's ludicrous to me that you would focus in on a small group of people in a small part of the world 2,000, 3,000 years ago and say, these are my ancestors. Well, yes, they are some of your ancestors. But what about the millions of others who are from all sorts of different cultures? Because the further back you go, the broader the fan of the ancestors become. So then it really is coming back to then personal identity and reaffirming your own personal identity, in which case then you're not honoring your ancestors, you're honoring yourself. And I feel like that can become very, very unhealthy very quickly. So get off my
soapbox. Yeah. No, I've never come across that. Actually, that people only want to revere their pagan ancestors. Right. So when you brought that up in the book, I was interested in that because usually that question definitely comes up. How do I get my Christian ancestors to not be mad at me for inviting them in on Samhain or something? But I feel like if we can get past the fears of what might happen and we actually just do it, we just invite them in, we write a letter to them, we leave an offering for them, we host a dumb supper and invite them, whatever we do.
Well,
they're going to show up and show you they're not upset about it.
And I think that's been my experience too. And how much of our fear, our resistances are just projections of
exactly.
They're not true. We just believe they're true because we've been told that, you know, XYZ is going to happen. We've watched too much Supernatural or we watched too much Charmed or whatever the messaging is that we've internalized. Like, what are your thoughts on that? Like, how much of that is projection?
Oh, it's totally projection. Mm. Absolutely, it's projection. I think, well, I say that. I don't like making generalizations, even though I've done nothing but generalize up to this point.
Time to redeem.
Oh, well.
but I think that there is a trend, and I think that that is coming from oftentimes it's that for some people it can be religious trauma, right? It's the projection of religious trauma, the assumption that this is going to happen. I think that with the cultural piece, I think people can often find themselves, especially if they're outside of a very strong living culture, you've got multiple forces telling people that they can't do this, they shouldn't do that, they can't do that. Now, that being said, I am also a strong traditionalist. I believe that if you are going to try to, if you're interested in a particular tradition, you need to become part of that tradition to engage with it. You can't just pick and choose. So I will say that right off the bat, because cultural appropriation is a very damaging thing. And what I say in the book about it, apart from the cultural piece, it's damaging on a spiritual way too, because it's, to me, all ritual, all religion, all magic is a form of communication. When we're performing magic, what are we doing? We're communicating with the weird, with the weave, with the cosmological laws, right? To try to bend them to our will. But it's still a form of communication. When we're working with our gods, when we're bowing down at the altar, whatever, and building shrines, we're creating a form of communication with them. Same with the ancestors. When we're engaging in ritual practice with the ancestors, we're communicating with them. So cultural appropriation to me is like somebody going to a party they're not invited to, walking to a group of people that are enjoying themselves and trying to use inside jokes that they don't understand to try to get attention in that moment. It becomes very awkward very quickly.
That's a very good way of putting it. I like that.
Yeah, it takes time to learn what those inside jokes are. But when you have that sense of belonging and those other people see that you belong with them, they'll make new inside jokes with you, right?
Does the magic and mystery of the green world, plant allies, land spirits, herbs, flowers, and very old trees inspire you? Join me for Of Leaf and Stone, A Guide to Natural Magic and Green Witchery, a live online workshop, and learn animistic folk practices grounded in nature. This event comes with a full resource folder, including a workbook, rituals, recipes, meditations, and more from my personal Green Witch grimoire. Join me May 11th at 4 p.m. EST. All tickets come with lifelong access to the recording. Follow the link in the show notes or visit seekingnumina.com/workshops for more information. And if you missed it live, you can always grab the recording. I hope to see you there.
So I noticed you start at the beginning of the story, in a sense. Like, for the most part, people sometimes even forget to say who the ancestors are. You not only cover that, you know, who are the ancestors, what makes someone an ancestor, how to look beyond blood relatives, which we'll get to that too. But you start the book, chapter one, with the nature of the living. Why did you think that was so important to include and to start on that foot?
Well, it was kind of interesting. As I was starting to put this down, I realized that every tradition makes assumptions about then who the living are, what the nature of being alive is, what the nature of personhood is. And that makes total sense, because the normal way that religious traditions are perpetuated is people are born into those traditions. So those people are with those concepts from the very beginning all the way up. Really, mass conversion and changing into different spiritualities and taking up new spiritual paradigms and worldviews is more of a recent thing. Especially in neo-paganism, like, really, we're only talking about 100 years here. So I feel like it's important for people, when engaging with anything, to come back to the basics, to really evaluate for themselves, okay, well, what are these words that we're actually using? What are the implications? Because personhood in one context can be very different in another context. And if you're working with, say, Egyptian deities, for example, not realizing that the self in Egyptian traditions, because it's such a massive cultural paradigm, changes and evolves and is different, then you're essentially crafting your Western worldview onto an ancient tradition. So you're not really going to connect in. I know some friends in the heathen tradition who say the same thing, right? The sense of honor in the Western kind of Christian modern world is very different from honor when it came to the sources. And so when people read those words, there's a lot of assumptions. Same with gods, right? Oftentimes, I feel like, again, and maybe at least you haven't come across some of these people, but I have, people will craft onto their patron deities really their relationship with Christian God, right? This omnipotent, omniscient being. When you actually go to the cultures that those deities come from, they didn't have those qualities. And so I feel like it's really important for people to really understand what they actually believe and go into that subconscious zone in order to then make good decisions for themselves. So when it comes to working in multiple cultures then, what did your medieval ancestors from Greece think about the person, and how did that then come into their spiritual traditions? If you're going to be taking up those spiritual traditions and communicating with them, how do you really think about what dead means? And you know, what are the abilities of the dead then? If they're not no longer living, if that makes any sense. So I thought it was very important to start with basics as an introductory guide. It was important for me to hold on to somebody's hands and kind of lead them through, almost like Paradise Lost or like Dante's Inferno. You know, it's less demons.
Yeah,
yeah, demons, I like that.
That's the feel, like, because for a lot of people, I think that's why they don't dip their toes into ancestor work, because it feels bigger and it's so personal. And so the answers you get when you ask questions is often like, well, what does it mean to you? And they're like, well, I don't know what it means to me. So I felt like, especially the inclusion of journal prompts throughout the book, I felt like really it helps people from any walk of life, from any background, from any level of experience, start thinking about where they come. Like, you described how many different cultures view where the ancestors reside. And sure, we know there's like there's heavens and hells, there's the Summerlands, there's the Elysian Field, you know. But more than that, how do you get to them? Do you bury your offerings because they're below the earth? Do you raise them up? Do you burn them so that they, you know, go into the air? Yeah. It's the deep questions that are the simple questions, really, but we don't often ask them.
Well, and this is the thing, because most, like, the recent history of spirituality and religion is that people are changing religions all the time, right? That's not a common thing in world history. And I know you both know this. It's one of those things where, you're raised in a culture, most things then just become background noise. You take it for granted. You just understand that the offering needs to be buried in the earth, because that's where the earth, that's where the spirits are, right? And so when you look at then joining or taking on new traditions, and my cat has a lot of things to say to this too, it's one of those things then all...
We love the kitties.
She's great. I love her so much. All ritual then has logic to it. And I feel like that's the bridging stone to the next major piece, which is becoming intentional with ritual. Because I see a lot of people who are new to these practices just think about decoration as decoration. Well, no, it's not decoration. It's a form of communication. That color that you're using, that choice that you're using in your shrine here, that gesture that you're performing, all intentional. It's all part of this symbolic way of communicating. And so it's not just decorative, right? So then when it comes to food, for example, a really good example there. So if you're putting down a plate of offerings of food, where you're putting it, in what direction you're putting it, what you're putting on the plate is also really important in some traditions, because it's all part of that expectation. It's like the ritual of... many of the Slavic countries, that ritual of offering bread with salt, two primal symbols of life. So you're welcoming your guests with life, like, come into our home. This is life, right? That's a huge symbolic piece. And it's way of really, like, embedding that in. So really it's about, again, people who are finding themselves in those liminal spaces in between traditions, becoming conscious of and in consciousness of ritual practice, you become empowered, because then you can make really empowered choices around what you're then going to do. And then the question of, well, what can I do, doesn't come into it anymore.
Absolutely. You saying that, like, brings me back, because we've been doing this for so long. A lot of us are like, oh, I'm just doing it because that's what I do. We forget that there's a purpose behind it, but the purpose behind it just becomes part of the act, and you don't explain it. You don't voice it.
Yeah.
And I think newer people coming in, they're like, well, why did you do that? And you're like, oh, now I have to think about it. Why did I do that? Okay. That's why I did that. You know, I put out the color purple because that's significant to this, this, and this, or, you know, put out the salt and the bread because it's significant for a reason. And yeah, it reminds me, because I just behind my altar, like, I have a string of beads that's sacred to my work, and it fell down behind. So I've been trying to fish it out of this, like, crevice that it fell into. So it's like one of those things where you're like, oh my God. and I found myself yesterday thinking about, like, well, why is it so important? Do I really need to, you know, contort myself underneath this hutch to find the string of beads? And I'm like, wait. Yeah. And you saying that, like, just solidified, like, why is that important? Because of that symbolism that it represents on the altar, it needs to be there. It's important. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's not something that we have to necessarily explain away, but it's definitely that, again, that primal urge to connect. And that's how we do it.
Very much so. And I think that speaks to, again, when we're living our practice, there's so many things that we do, like you were saying, Leandra, that just become, you know, just natural, right? And to bring this to food, because I know this is the whole podcast here, I love how grumpy Max Miller gets when he's going through old cookbooks, and they'll say, like, Mrs. Beaton, for example, will say, prepare the dough in the usual way. And it's like, well, tell us what the usual way is.
The usual
right?
way, yeah.
That's part of that material culture. That's part of that just subconscious part of the culture that people just already know because they were raised in it. And I feel like people who are coming into or reclaiming or forming their own traditions have to be even more intentional. But I think that really it's just like learning how to cook. You know, you learn a cookbook, you learn a recipe through a cookbook first until you really learn and you're in a relationship with the ingredients. Same with when you're blending new teas, right, Leandra? You know what each of those blends tastes like even before you've put them together, right?
And that's a good point, because a lot of people, when they come to me for instruction, they're like, well, how do I do that?
Mm.
I always come back like, this is something that you need to develop on your own. If you want to set up your circle in a certain way, that's your thing. So prepare it in the usual way. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be my way. I'll give you an option, sure. And I think that's why I like your book so much, is because you give mm-hmm. those options out there, but you're not, like you mentioned before, like you're not giving this that do this and do that. This is the only way to do it because I said so, you know?
Yes. And I had to be very careful with that. And like, it's funny. So I run my own podcast too, and I've had a lot of, like all of them have been vegan authors too. And oftentimes I've asked them that question, sometimes privately, you know, what was it like for you with writing exercises? And kind of the dirty secret of the vegan authorship world is that all of us hate giving exercises because even if partly because it's like, how do you translate something that you do all the time? Also, partly it's how do I become ethical in what I provide here? So if it's like a very particular tradition, then you're offering a very particular traditional point of view. But for a lot of these like 101 witchcraft books where it's like, well, you know, how do you rate this without unintentionally giving somebody something by rote, right? Being like, especially for people who are coming from specifically Christianity, where mm-hmm. it's like, thou shalt.
Yeah, right? thou shalt not.
if you're looking at empowering people to take ownership of their practice, even giving them a list of your correspondences can impact them. And then suddenly you have a situation like, I know Gemma McGarry found herself in this situation where suddenly all of these people across North America were practicing Cornish witchcraft because Gemma McGarry told us about it.
Right.
And Gemma McGarry was like, well, no, this is a form of Cornish witchcraft.
And that's what I run into with exercises and giving people even meditations. I'm like, this is a suggestion. This is not the be all end all. And I think I sound like a broken record to our listeners and to anybody who reads my books or follows me anywhere, because that's exactly what I don't want to happen. I don't want you to take what I do and make it law and make it this thing that you have to do, because it's not. This is just what I have come to bring into my practice. Totally. And this is just how I do it. If you don't like it, go find another way. Go for it.
Exactly. This is the thing. And I think we can see so many examples where somebody has done something like that and suddenly it's become law. Like I look to the academic world, and Lisa, you'll know this from your own studies and your spiritual background, right? How many people think certain things about Greek gods because Edith Hamilton told them so, and they learned that in high school, right? That one single book. Same with, you know, with the Golden Bough. How many people think all sorts of different things about Italian deities because, you know, the Golden Bough told them so, right? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's where we did an episode a little while ago on personal gnosis and how we need to actually share these experiences. Like, of course, there's private things that we'll have experiences with, but when it comes to, like, you know, you work with Hecate, I work with Hecate, let's say. If we share what she's like, we will find commonalities that may or may not be in these texts. And the thing is, too, like, for our listeners, most of them do not speak ancient Greek. So your sources are skewed as it is. You know, like, we've got one translation to work from with the Greek magical papyri, really. So, like, that's one issue. Like, you just run into, if you, like, We had Morpheus Ravenna on, and we were talking about like reconstructionists, like true, like, and this is in the quotation marks, I'm doing exactly what the ancients did, folks. It's like, unfortunately, you have to, and this is hard in the beginning of your path, but you have to get comfortable with the fact that you just can't, you cannot do exactly what your ancients did. You just can't, because we don't know, exactly. Especially when we're looking at, like, you know, Britain. for instance, like there's just no written record where it's from the enemies, the guys who came and invaded. It's not clear. Even Greece, all we have is Athens area, Attica. That's it. So like all three of us actually were in the ancestral magic summit with Bruja Botanica in November of 2023. And that's what I presented on actually is like Lorari altars, like Greek and Roman magic. And I kind of start by like bursting everyone's bubble that like, this is just what we have the archaeological record of. Who knows what the beginning and end of the ritual looked like, you know, like sure it existed. Yes, it was in kitchens. These are facts, but
yeah,
you know,
this is the trouble. I think this is where like, I love my reconstructionist folk. I really do. Oftentimes they're coming and they're looking and wanting to ground their practice in evidence. But the major flaw of reconstruction is you are taking a vast continuum of time and you're hobbling together pieces into one unified form. Pieces that organically may have been 2,000 years apart, right? I think this is my sense. This is why folkloric practice is becoming such a big kind of area now. And a lot of writers are now moving and shifting towards that because folkloric practice represents that continuation of tradition in an organic sense. You know, elements are coming in, elements are being assimilated. And in truth, I mean, for a very long time, I had very anti-Christian views. But I'll be honest with you, there was always a little piece inside of me. Now, I didn't grow up in a Christian household. My parents aren't Christian. You know, the only time I really went to a Baptist school, church was because of the week that they gave that, you know, my parents off. I went to vacation Bible school. So it was one of those, like, it wasn't really a Christian household for me, but culturally Christianity, was such a big and is such a big part of British culture and being British and having that really strong connection with Britain, it was awkward for me because as a pagan, well, I should be anti-Christian, you know, those fucking Christians, all that.
Yeah.
And yet deep down inside, it was like, well, no, I kind of love the saints. I love going into churches and just that ambience. And I love just that part, that social part of the culture. And folkloric witchcraft really gave me that back, right? Folkloric approach really gave me that license to then start to explore that part of my heritage. Even if I'm not Christian, it's still a part of my culture. So it's recon. I think there's a lot of changes going on in Reconstructionism as I think we're all aging out. I think that there's a big group of us 20 years ago that started out on Pagan Space and Mystic Wicks and all these like places, Witch Vox.
Oh man.
And we're all now aging all up those into that place. Yeah, right? But it's funny. You think of a lot of the writers right now. Think about to look at it, the bulk of us are all in our 30s and early 40s. We're all of that age where we were online 20 years ago, right? It's kind of neat.
Watching the transitions of things and then how the ideals kind of ebb and flow. And yeah, it's fun. Yeah.
Well, and even like ceremonial practice was so important 20 years ago. And now, like you even in your book, you're like, well, what is ritual? It's showing up with intention. Like we don't have to put on the robes and, you know, like we used to really hammer it in like certain facets, even in my own tradition. Like I'm initiated in a tradition, but even my high priestess, the way her practice has evolved in the past 30 some years is like fascinating to witness even, you know, I wasn't there 30 years ago when she began, but there's something powerful about how the collective consciousness is shifting and to be a witness to it, to be a part of it is fun.
I feel like paganism of at least now, after like the big wave of paganism that started really with Scott Cunningham's book and Ray Buckland's book and that opening up of paganism in the 90s is now we're reaching our 20s. You know, we're reaching our we're just past our teenage years where we're rebelling against everything and we had to be a certain thing. And now we're getting to that place. And I, like I said, you know, a lot of the authors I know, every other week we're starting to get gray hairs and all this. But
oh yeah. The whole aging process, isn't it fun? I wonder if like maybe our shift from the high ceremonial magic to all the fluff and the I don't know. I always thought of it, now that that I look back, I think of it as like pomp and circumstance, even though it's really not, but it has purpose. But I wonder if like it, part of that is like you start to realize that it's not so necessary. You can get just as much vitality from your work through simple practices that don't expend so much mental and emotional energy.
Well, and I think that's a really good point. I think that from a psychological point of view, if we look at it in a developmental stage point of view, right? Oftentimes, when somebody is starting to explore themselves and steps into being who they are, they don't know who they are. So what do? They take on all of those outside trappings. We see this with teenagers when they suddenly find their cliques. You know, suddenly everybody's an emo, suddenly everybody's a jock, suddenly everybody is taking on the outer aspects to feel like they belong. And I feel like 20 years ago, 10 years ago even, I feel like in the community there was a sense of wanting to belong to particular traditions. And so the outward trappings were taken on as a form of look at me, I belong here, I belong here. And then those who stuck with those practices, it's like, no, this is me, this is my stuff. You know, I was recently talking to Irene Glass, who is the one of the main organizers of Sacred Space Conference. And we were talking about their pilgrimage to Iceland. And what it was like to go to like a hof or a blot with some of the local Icelandic heathens. And this is something that I've heard from other people too. A lot of North American heathens can be very shocked that people are showing up in Iceland to blot or to hof with, you know, sleep pants on, or like, you know, like they're not in robes, they're not in face paint, they're not all of that. And it's just a lived experience there, because it's like, well, yeah, that's where the ancient Temple of Thor was. And that's where I go and get my groceries. And that's where, same in Europe, I would say, right? It's kind of a neat, interesting thing. And that was an invitation for Irene, they were saying, to just be, to just live, to not have to kind of make a show of it. But I think that making a show of it is also part of that developmental stage, you know.
Well, it's fun. I mean, it's nice to dress up.
It is, it is.
Paint and the horns and whatever else you're going to put on. But I wonder if, like, for me at least, like this whole process of discovering who I am in my craft and what really matters to me, it's been about living it daily. So you can't do the ceremonial things, the high ceremonial jewelry and makeup and, you know, robes and that sort of thing every single day. It would be, you know, going to the bathroom would even be hard. So it just makes sense that we would kind of, you know, casual it, you know, make it more casual and make everything a little more easy to work with. And I think that's where maybe we were led to believe wasn't the thing, that you shouldn't be so casual with it 20 years ago, where now we're stepping into that going, wait a minute, it can be just as meaningful, just like, you know, the sacred places next to the grocery store. Like, why can't we also find sacredness in the grocery store as we're shopping? You know, sacredness as we clean, sacredness as we garden, in all these places. And I, yeah, for me, that's really where it's landed, is this is my life. This is who I am on a daily basis. And I use my altar every day, and it's the way I like it, but it's not something, you know, where I, you know, section it off with the quarters and the different, you know, it's usable. And I think that's important for a lot of newbies in this path, is to think about how does it function for you on a daily basis.
Completely.
And I directly relate that to ancestor veneration. Like, do you talk to your ancestors every day? Who are you talking to? What are you trying to get out of that? And I think that's an important aspect to remember, that it doesn't have to be over the top complicated all the time. But yeah, like, let's go Absolutely. Dress up every once in a while and make a big deal and do the dumb supper and that sort of thing.
It's a wonderful part of the emerging culture, right? And as I feel like this blanket pagan kind of identity is now starting to separate out into smaller groups. So understand that they're interrelated, and it can become part of that kind of the lived material culture of the practice. But you're absolutely right; it's about lived practice too, and it's I suspect that 20 years ago, when the focus was on making a show and and dressing up and it becoming a big thing. I suspect that that was partly because there were so many new people coming into the practice, again, that developmental stage. I suspect also it was part of trying to show the world that it was safe because of satanic panic about 10 years before that. And I also suspect that it also had to do with some of the shows that we had on at the time, right? Buffy the Vampire Slayer, The Craft, you know, all of these things. It was like, again, that wanting to emulate and bring into our lives. Now I think we're at a stage in the community where it's, we can just live and be, right? But, and you're absolutely right.
Hey there, witches. Did you know that there's an entire community out there dedicated to you and your journey? The Rebel Mystic community is a space where I offer my decades of knowledge and experience to witches just like you. I do this through live events, monthly mentoring, monthly rituals, a book club, and other resources like workbook pages and meditations. There is even a complete self-paced course library you can access. Check the link in the show notes to learn more about this community and how to become a member. Blessed be.
So now I have a question for you two. Being that this is a podcast about food and whatnot, what is it like in a spiritual sense for you both to enter a grocery store? What is that like for you? You opened it up, Leandro. You have to answer.
I know I did. Oh my God. Honestly, like it's the state of mind that I'm in. So if I'm rushing, then it's like a typical grocery store trip and I'm just like, get me out of here, you know. I don't want to be here. But if I am going in with intention, because I'm cooking a sacred meal, because I'm cooking something with intention, then it's different. Then I slow down and I'll even put earbuds in and just listen to music that resonates with me. So it's depends on the purpose of the trip. Mm-hmm. So if it's an everyday just whatever trip, I just need to put dinner on the table because everybody's hungry, then it's more a mundane focus for me. But if I'm going in with the intention of creating something that is meaningful for, you know, say I'm going to celebrate Beltane and I'm going to cook, you know, I'm going to do, I like to do like the Beltane tea. So I do a tea spread with the sandwiches and little, you know, bite-sized foods and that sort of thing. Then it's a lot more intentional. And yeah, so then the more ceremonial aspect of my training comes through where I'm very focused and I'm very particular about what I get. And yeah, so yeah, it depends on the day, I guess.
But you're going in with intention. I really love that. Yeah.
Yes. And yeah. I think that's the catalyst. Me, yeah.
For me, I actually, in Greece, we don't really do the grocery store as much because it's still in a bit of an old fashioned way where you go to the butcher for your meat, you go to the baker for your bread, and your dairy, and you go to I have just a dude on the side of the street, actually, next to Artemis's temple that grows vegetables on her temple land. So you can imagine what we're talking about here. Like when I go back to the States, I usually go for extended visits and my body genuinely starts to miss fresh produce. And where I go back to in the States is farm country. Right. But for some reason, I will say this too, in the US and in the UK a bit more as well than in Greece specifically, we don't eat out of season. Mm. Partly it's privilege because in Greece we always have an area that's growing certain things like onions, potatoes, tomatoes, cucumbers. You can get those all year. But if you're talking about a fruit, like it's pomegranate season as we're recording this, in May or April when this is coming out, it will be the second season for certain fruits, like oranges. So we only eat those when it's time. So you become more embedded with the landscape that way. And I think in my work, like, which is focused on land spirits and connection to spirits of place, that is so much easier. Mm. But then in the States, when I am relegated to the grocery store and it's like, it's Walmart, like where I stay in the States. And that's depressing on other levels. So the energy of the store is just gone. But there is a little Amish stand I go to
For the basics, like they'll always have whatever's in season, but the Amish use all kinds of sprays and stuff. Like, it is not anyone who goes to an Amish market and they think that they're getting like fresher produce. Like, no, they use Roundup, my friends.
Yeah, it's really bad.
It's true. Where I was living, it was Waterloo, Ontario, which is like the heart of Mennonite country in Ontario, right?
And interesting. I didn't know that.
It's really,
yeah, we've got those fellows down here.
Exactly right. So Kitchener, which is a city right next to Waterloo, used to be called Berlin, and it was like the center of the German population in the whole region. And so it's a beautiful place called St. Jacob's Market, which is a big, like, open air, like Mennonite Amish market, right? And a news report a couple of years ago showed that a lot of Mennonites would go down to the food terminal in Toronto and get all of their produce. And because they, I mean, let's be honest, they weren't growing peppers on their farms. Let's be honest.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, yeah, it's a misnomer. You're just paying more. But but yeah, it's interesting. And I do, to bring it back to ancestor work, I do leave offerings depending on the fruits of the season. Like, it's so traditional in Greece and Rome, and honestly, I think throughout Europe, to leave first fruits as the offering. So whatever's the first of whatever I forage, because foraging is very cultural here, I leave the first of it on my altar, because I don't have a garden or anything. I just have the land around me. Mm-hmm. So that's a big offering for me. And I think we can still do that. Like, no matter where you live, no matter how industrial, there is something in season. Like, you will see the first dandelion. Mm-hmm. You will see the first, you know, leaf that changes on the tree fall on the ground. Like, these can be our first fruits. It doesn't have to literally be a fruit.
And what I love about that is, like, you're really underlining a point that I'm becoming a lot more aware of in my life, especially as somebody who's about to move back to my home country, where there are, you know, particular foods that came into season at particular times. Food in itself, I think a lot of people, and maybe you've seen this with this podcast, people tend to ignore the power of food and how important food is.
Underrated.
And very much underrated, right? Like the whole Slavic tradition of offering bread and salt. Well, when you actually think about what salt is, it's been a preservative for thousands of years. Same with bread. It's one of the very first staple foods, right? You're not just eating bread, you're eating 30,000 years of history, right?
Yeah, and that was one of the reasons why I started the Magic Kitchen blog and then later the podcast, is because food was such, I guess, a dismissed portion of our practice as witches, as magical people in ancestor veneration, because food becomes that connection, that communication. And we touched on this a little bit earlier, but it is that communication. So it's that expression. You know, in my practice, we do a lot of like milk, honey, but also tea. Like, I will, my first cup of tea of the day, I will leave a bit of it out on my altar. Mm-hmm. And it's a simple act, but it gets dismissed, like you said, because it's, oh, I did it in my kitchen. But, you know, the tea or alcohol, even, you know, how ancient is alcohol? And that's another thing I'll leave is very wine or whiskey or bourbon, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, so very much so. Yeah. Really cool. Literally spiritus, right?
Yep. And that's that's how it got its name, is because they believed that it was releasing a spirit. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. 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 It's an interesting thing. And I feel like the kitchen witches who get it, and that suddenly becomes a huge part of their practice, right? Like, it's like the nerdiness piece, like, you know, the kitchen witch is coming, and, you know, but it's like suddenly like amazing food, amazing stories, amazing folklore, all the whole culture just opens up for people. Same with herbs. I think it's very similar. The herb type nerds, all like the whole culture, it becomes the open gateway to that. But what I love about that is that it's such a visceral thing, right? And I hope that comes across in the book. I don't think it necessarily did, but, I try to explain to people what even cooking for your ancestors or for your spirits can become like, right? One of my favorite things is taking a recipe. And my family doesn't have a lot of family recipes. A lot of stuff got kept in the UK amongst our extended family. And when we moved over here, there was that disconnection. But one of the recipes that we have is my Auntie Florence's, or great Auntie Florence's, lemon curd recipe. And every time my dad makes that, what I'm tasting is the same thing that she tasted and so many other ancestors tasted. It might not be that particular type of lemon curd that I have in front of me, but the taste is the same because the recipe is the same. And that suddenly it's like we all enter into a shared paracosm of that taste. And it becomes amazing to think of it in that way. Other aspects of ritual practice can be like that too. When you're engaging in a practice that your ancestors also engaged in, you're physically enacting the same movements that they did. Suddenly there's a contact point going across time, right? Fascinating.
It takes
coming down into that sense of awareness for that. And I think that's the power of tradition, really. That power of tradition is, but I think that a lot of pagans, a lot of spiritual people have in their head what tradition should look like, which is, you know, ritual, wearing clothes and all, you know.
Yeah.
It can be simply just sitting, taking a deep breath in a particular place, knowing that maybe your ancestors sat in that space too.
And I think it comes to listening. So this happened recently. I was making something that my mom had made for years. My grandmother had taught her how to make it. So it was a traditional dish that my family has made for, I don't know how long. And my son came in to help me make it. And I'm like, okay, now add this ingredient. He's like, okay, how much? I'm like, I had to stop myself because I don't remember how much. I always listened. They told me when to stop.
Yeah.
They told me how much. So I had to stop myself to teach him how to listen to that as well. Mm-hmm. And I'm getting goosebumps talking about it, but yeah. It was just, it's such that moment where you're connecting through the recipe, through the food, through the action, through the process to the energy of your ancestors, to their communication. Yeah. And then you make this amazing thing and it tastes better than it ever should because there's something extra in there. You can't measure that.
It's true. I mean, it's like that meme going around, you know, I don't measure ingredients. I pour until my Nona says stop. Right.
Yes. Yes. I've seen that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. But that's then relationship, right? You're relating to the food that you're making. You're relating to your spirits. You're relating to your child. You're relating to self because it takes some awareness to be able to listen and become. And so it's all about relationship. And I'm not sure how many thousands of times I use the word relationship in this book, but it's one of the primal things. And I feel like if people... That's really the goal of all of this, is to learn to relate to spirit, relate to God, to relate to ancestors, relate to self, right? All of that is about relationship. And it's funny that this conversation is coming up. I was putting together a class on weird for various parts of my life. And that's what weird essentially comes down to, is learning how to relate to self. You know, learning how to relate to fate, and that fate is relationship to self, to other people, and the unfolding of those relationships. It's amazing. Yeah.
So I've got one more question for you. Pilgrimage. That was my favorite chapter in the book.
Yeah.
And it's very integral to my own work as a tour guide in Greece, and even seeking noumena means literally seeking spiritual sacred places. So how, in your opinion, how does pilgrimage factor into ancestor work, and what makes it a pilgrimage versus a trip?
Yes. So this was pointed out to me by the British Pilgrimage Trust. So I need to put that out there, that they really helped me to understand this piece. What makes it a pilgrimage is two things. You're out of your comfort zone. And when we move out of our comfort zone, we enter into a liminal space of possibility. And we're connecting. So in the case of pilgrimage, a pilgrimage can actually be anything. It's different from going on vacation, because when you're going on vacation, you're looking to relax. When you go on pilgrimage, you're not looking to relax. You're looking to expand. You're looking to relate. You're looking to grow, And that's the major difference between the two. So when somebody goes on an ancestral journey, and I think a lot of North Americans of settler background end up thinking about going on ancestral journey relating to their blood relatives, they're looking at homelands somewhere else. And so going into those places, even though they're in the physical places as they are now, it's that you're actually entering into the paracosm where your ancestors are also in that place. So people coming back to Greece, people going back to the UK, this very personal one for me, right? I hear this all the time from North Americans. I'm going to go and I'm going to learn the history. I'm going to go to the castles. I'm going to go find where my home is. And then they get over there and they go to those places. It often doesn't have any relationship to the actual reality of that space, right? They're not going to go to Weatherspoons. They're not going to go to, they're not going to notice some of the chavs on the corner, right? They're just focused on that relationship to their ancestors. So it's that relationship through place, right? And our blinders go up, I think, often. But it is that searching, that seeking. But it's really important to get out of your comfort zone. And so pilgrimage can happen, I think, by proxy. And I talk about that in the book too. But you're still, there's an element of still being in a comfort zone. It's physically going somewhere. Because when you physically go somewhere, you don't have control. And I think that's the other key piece here too, is that oftentimes people who go on a spiritual pilgrimage, they're entering into a state of not having direct control versus a vacation where it's all laid out for them and this and all the other. People who've gone on vacation and it's turned into a pilgrimage often will speak about that. There was a point where suddenly they found themselves lost and they found themselves again because they had that ancestral connection or suddenly they went seeking for something. And I feel like I'm just going around in circles and circles, but it's a very important thing. It's a very important thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
I hope that answers the question.
It did. Yeah. It yeah. And it's good to hear from somebody else because I feel like I'm the broken record on how important it is to connect to place. And like with ancestry, that's really the only time in witchcraft I think people talk about it is like, oh, well, yeah, you should go to where you're quote unquote from, you know, because we also are from wherever we lived. You know, people always are like, oh, I wish I could visit a sacred site. I'm like, they're all around you. You don't have to go to Stonehenge. Like, there are sacred places in any given place in the world.
This is true.
But to connect where your ancestral heritage is unbelievable, you know, especially to really find their graves if you have the luck to have that information accessible.
Yeah,
it's powerful.
One last piece on that, and I think that's the other part of the book that I really love, that I loved working on, was the idea of even expanding the concept of ancestor. And so pilgrimage is a good thing for that, right? I think people who go on vacation because they want to go to, you know, like with England, for example, they want to go to Austin country. They want to go to a particular place because they read about it. Or it's connected with something that they love, in their life, right? That can be a pilgrimage of idea. And the British Pilgrimage Trust, Will Parsons and, I can't think of what his name is. And Will Worthington. They talk about going and having a pilgrimage of idea. One of the examples that they talk about in one of the podcasts they were on was going and singing a particular song connected to Wordsworth. So they went to his home and they recited the poem and they honored him because it was and in that way it was an ancestral pilgrimage to that idea. So I think that, you know, when we talk about ancestors, just expanding that from blood, going to Stonewall in the bar in New York City, for example, for a lot of North American queer people can be very ancestral because, well, that's where the place where the U.S. Gay rights movement started, right? In my case, when I go back home to the U.K., going to Tintagel, going to places connected with King Arthur, going to Sherwood Forest is a pilgrimage because I'm going outside of my comfort zone. And it's not just a vacation because I'm not relaxing, but I'm going to honor those figures from my childhood that were really important to me. So I feel like everything can then suddenly become ancestral. It depends on how we relate to it.
And even with your parallels you put throughout the book to Lord of the Rings, I can't let you go without mentioning this. That's for me the same thing. Like I my first pilgrimage I embarked on totally solo was in college. I did a semester abroad at Oxford University in a Tolkien study. And all I did was visit Tolkien sites because he was so instrumental before I even had, you know, words for connection to spirit of place. He taught me how to do that. You know, it's so any reader of Lord of the Rings knows like how important it is to,
yeah,
for, you know, like the species are tied to places, to types of places.
Yes.
So these fictional ancestors, I like that inclusion in the book because they do form us. They influence us. Like I always say, like I define, if I had to give a sentence to define ancestors in my practice, it's anyone who had a significant impact on who I am today. So a mentor who died, mm-hmm, a fictional character, a family member, a step family member, you know, people get so hung up on blood and it's like, it's not that important. Really? It is. Yeah. It's cool, but it's, you know, if you're adopted, guess who your ancestors are? They're your family.
It's a thing. And again, that comes back to worldview, really brings us back to the beginning of the book, understanding worldview and understanding how that worldview impacts then how you see these beings, because that piece around adopted relatives comes up again and again and again and again and again, because people culturally, we have this subtle text of, oh, well, you know, they're just adoptive relatives. They're not really your family. Mm. That doesn't matter if you go to other cultures where that very much does. Like Augustus Caesar, right, was very much believing that he was the son of Julius Caesar, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and we're happy to say as modern pagans, like, oh, I wish I could go back to the times where we communally raised children, where we communally looked out for each other, but then to turn and say, oh, but I only recognize my blood as my ancestors.
Yeah.
It doesn't go together. We can't have both. You have to say, do you believe in community or are you going to be one of these hardcore? I don't even that expression, like blood is thicker than water. Like that's the first half.
Yeah, that's not,
you know, like it's not it.
But it's that mental block, right? Mm-hmm. And so understanding that mental block is even there, you can make then intentional choices around that. And there are people I've worked with who work with ancestor work and they say, no, I only feel like blood relatives are my ancestors. Okay. So then these other spirits and beings in your life, you know, how are you going to work with them? Because I still want to work with them.
Yeah.
I'm going to work with them in a separate way. And that's okay. Yeah. As long as you're being intentional with what you're doing, right? You know? Yeah. One last point, because I have to bring it back to food. What I love about, this is what I love about these cookbooks that are connected to, like, you know, Jane Austen's cookbook, and it has like all the recipes, all the food that appears, you know, things like that. This is where pilgrimage by proxy can become really fun, but really interesting too, is that I've seen people do where they'll take and they'll create a whole banquet of just food connected to these books. And it becomes then a relationship with these characters. They do readings, they invite their friends over who love, you know, these books as well. And so as you're eating each thing, you'll be reading passages from these books. And then it becomes an intimate, kind of dumb supper for these fictional characters. I love it. Yeah. And I really want to do it myself. I really want to do it myself.
I want to do one too. Cookbooks
too, right?
Yeah, that sounds like fun.
So it doesn't have to be all like gloom and doom. It can be fun too.
Well, I think that's important. Like, we have to make this fun. We have to make it something that we want to do, that we're excited to do, or else we're not going to do it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Real talk. Leandro and I could be trying to sell you socks or a VPN or that cereal everybody talks about, but we like to keep it witchy around here instead. And we can only do that because of the support of listeners like you. When you're joining my magical living community on Patreon, you're not only getting weekly shadow work journal prompts, new moon and full moon rituals, exclusive videos, exclusive meditations, plus bonus episodes of the Magic Kitchen podcast. But you're seriously keeping the lights on in the Magic Kitchen. Thank you for listening and reviewing the show. And if you're ready to meet me in the Magic Kitchen, pop over
to patreon.com/Elise Wells and start your free trial. Let's deepen your magical practice together.
Well, thank you for being here, Ben. This was a great conversation. I feel like we could talk for many, many hours.
I know.
And right? We do, in fact, but.
and Beltane. Beltane. We didn't get to Beltane, but Beltane.
Yes, we did not. Yeah. And the veil will be thin, according to Western modern traditions. So it's a great time if you haven't started your ancestral practices. Mm-hmm. Next week is a good time.
Yeah. And many traditions surrounding that can be around, you know, in Samhain, we honor the ancestors as we're going into the time of in the Northern Hemisphere of death and pause and dying. In at Beltane, it's about new life. So it's looking forward with the blessings of the ancestors, bringing them in to bless the new crops, the new life, right? The ebb that is constantly happening and to bless us on our journey into that. So that can be a part of that work.
Yeah. Well, tell our listeners how they can keep in touch with you and keep up with your work.
Absolutely. So benstimpson.com is the best place to go. I have all of my courses on there. I have all of my the podcast interviews are on there. And also I am accepting clients, for those interested. I offer therapy and spiritual work. I will say this. I'm very proud of this. I have a lot of my classes, by the time this comes out at least, are going to be offered through Udemy. And so I will actually have on-demand classes available on there. So if anybody is interested in that, I do have those on because I have way too much time that I don't have. I don't have a lot of time to do in-person classes anymore. So
yeah. Oh, fantastic. I'm tired.
But this has been delightful. Thank you so much for having me on. And I'm looking forward to sharing this when this comes out.
Thank you.
I hope everybody has a great rest of 2024.
Yes, you too. Thank you.
Merry meet.
Merry part.
And merry meet again. Thank you for joining us on the Magic Kitchen podcast. Please visit my website, leandrawitchwood.com, for news, information, and more episodes.
I'm Elise Wells, and I can be found at Seeking Numina on YouTube, Instagram, and Facebook, and seekingnumina.com. That's Seeking, N-U-M-I-N-A.